Thank you, Alan. It's an honor to be here. I'm sorry that I have to come. There's a family simcha taking place in New York right now that I'm late for, but they're Syrian, so I'm assuming that when I get there at 12 o'clock at night, it'll be just fine. I'm banking on my people to be late, so that's good. So the topic for today is seeing the invisible, the power of the Torah in your life. And I want to begin by going backwards, so hopefully when I'm done, that you'll see the title will come in at the end. And I want to begin with a word that means a lot to us, even though we don't know what it means. When you live your life, lots of times you live your life and you ask yourself, what do you want in life? I'm going to move this out of the way. Is that okay? I just can't stand behind something for so long. My mom said if I was growing up now in school, there would be enough meds, I'd be a zombie. So my ADD can come out now. You live your life right now, when we think about what we want in life, there's a word that we use a lot that we don't know what it means, and that word is success. We want to have things that are successful. We want our kids to have a successful year in school. We want our jobs to be successful. We want our learning, our life. The end of life, what we want really is to live a life where what we've touched has ended in success. And the question is, how does one achieve success? Where is the principles of success in Torah? How does God guide us to make us be successful in all that we do in life? And the core of it, my belief, is that it comes to one idea. We say this incredible bracha called every time you drink something, or after you finish with shahak, we say bracha, b'ri nefashos rabos v'chesrona. We thank Hashem for creating nefashos rabos, people. Lots and lots and lots of people and their deficiencies. Rabbi Pesach Kron, I remember on a speech one asked, why do we thank for the deficiencies for? And the answer that he gives is that every single one of us would be born self-sufficient. If we would have the ability to have to do everything ourselves, we would accomplish things, but we would never be accomplished. That the core really of success is being able to be connected to other people. And the only way you are connected to other people is when you're able to fulfill something that they need. At the end of the day, if what we do, if we have no needs, or we pretend to have no needs, we're essentially alone. And as you go through life, what you find is that whatever I've accomplished in my life feels not as good as the people of which I've connected along the way. Because the true core of success really is the ability to connect. And how does one connect? The essence of connection is communication. The secret to communication is the secret of connection. The secret to connection is the secret of success. So how does one communicate? So we think that communication is speaking, but it's not. The majority of communication isn't the capacity or the ability to speak. The majority of communication is the ability to listen. Each person is speaking, but every one of us, when somebody else communicates to us, we have what we call blocks. And it's in these blocks that disable us from being able to properly connect. What do I mean? When people are talking, there are blocks. Sometimes the blocks are language. I've got a neighbor across the street. Chilled out, laid back American guy. He married a hot-blooded Israeli woman. He speaks no Hebrew. I kid you not. She speaks no English. Don't understand what your wife said, it's bliss to the end, that's what I hear. I don't agree with it at all, just tell me as they tell me. He wakes up every morning, I wake up, this guy's got smoking a cigarette, got a cup of coffee, he's enjoying the morning, she's screaming words I didn't even know her name. He looks at me and goes, what is she saying? I'm like, you should go in the house right now. She's Israeli, she'll kill you with her eyes, go in the house right now. They can love each other all day. If they're speaking a different language, they can't connect. Sometimes you speak in the same language, but it means different things. So I should go to go around to speak in different places. Francisca, there's one place in the world if I go to speak, I am so intimidated. I shake before I go here because everybody in this area sounds so smart. Anyone know what I'm talking about? London, England, right? Everybody who's English sounds like a professor. You know what I'm talking about? So I go speak one time in London, and I'm out in this big crowd, and as I'm walking up, literally, I see this like 8-year-old kid, like a little kid, and as I'm walking up, he puts his hand in his pocket and he goes, pulls out a candy, he goes, oh, hello. And I'm like, oh my gosh. said, would you not be sweet? I want to be your professor. So in England, they have words that we don't have in America, right? So I was in Israel for the year, and my roommate was English. And we're out in the Bar Kokhba caves. And he turns to me and goes, Chale, would you like a torch? I'm like, you brought a torch to the caves? I'm like, what are you, Indiana Jones? I'm like, yes, I want a torch. And he pulls out like a pocket flashlight. I'm like, this isn't a torch. You can speak your whole life to someone who's in them, and they'll use words, and the words have different meanings. So there's a lot. Sometimes in life, you won't be speaking at all, and it'll be two totally different conversations. This happens sometimes, stereotypically, if you will. Sometimes you have marriages where the man isn't as expressive. And so the wife will say, can you tell me that you love me? And the man will say, what do you mean? I'm waking up every morning. I'm working hard. I'm giving you what you want. My work is my way of saying I love you. And the wife will say, I need you to say it to me. Say the actual words, I love you. And the two of them could go an entire life. We're both looking at each other like they're crazy. The man going, what do you mean? Every day, when I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I don't ask any questions. I'm saying I love you. She's going, what do you mean you don't say I love you? And you go an entire life through this. Parents and kids all the time. Parents, you think that if mom doesn't say I love you, she doesn't love you. Then you have your own kids. Remember that feeling when you have your own kids? Remember that fear? Anybody here, when you bring your kids home for the first time in the hospital, and you're in the hospital, and as they give you that baby, your first thought is, for real? Like, I can just take this thing home? So there's no state laws against this, right? And you come home that first week, and I don't care if your wife's dead. I don't care if you're, like, if you were a nurse or you're a kindergarten teacher. When that baby's in your house for that first time, oh my gosh. You close that door, and your expectations. You don't screw up parenting that first week, that your expectations are so low. Right? The goal is just don't kill it. You know what I mean? Just walk, it's alive and it's dirty, but it's okay. It's breathing, you're winning, you're the best parent ever. And then you have your own kids, like, holy cow. My mom and dad didn't have to say they love me. Every diaper, every worry, everything. Is that love? You can go an entire life like this with two people, both communicating in the way that they feel comfortable communicating, and both unable to hear something else. Because the true essence of communication is having the humility to not listen in the way you speak, but to listen in the way they speak. My whole life I can be married to you, but I don't understand your language. Someone's going to have to break. And you go an entire life, I speak English. I use these words. My expressions are my sense of love. And you will have a block until one person says, I don't hear in the way I speak. I am machmia. I subserve myself to your way of speech. And the minute somebody is able to have that level of humility to listen to the way you speak, all of a sudden, they communicate. And by the way, anyone who's business, you know this is marketing 101. You don't put out products, you hear what people mean. This is relationships, parenting. This is how the world works. And unfortunately, people run them around, you know, this is the way we're doing it. And then around them is the ability to connect. Now this applies. This applies man to God. And that's what I want to delve into today. I want to delve into this idea. Who's the most successful? You have to just, Forbes is doing the Forbes 100 most successful Jews in history. Who would it be? Forget just Brooklyn's. Well, guys, I would go bigger. Biggest at Moshe, right? Even bigger. Who's the most successful rags to riches, unbelievable story?
Zuckerberg.
Bigger. Joseph. Wouldn't it be Joseph? Think about it. Egypt was the epicenter of civilization. The man who controlled the world's food. We're Jews. We know how important that is. The man who controlled the world's food was Yosef. And if you look at his life, you would think that Yosef's life basically was like, he was the best kid in yeshiva, and he looked amazing, and everybody loved him, and then he went to business school on yeshiva morning, and he got his degree from Harvard, and then they needed to listen. They needed a guy, so they figured, let me appoint the COO of Yaakov's organization. And like, his life was perfect. If you look at his life, you will find him amazing. Yosef's life was arguably the most insane, dysfunctional life we have in the entire Torah. And I want for men this morning to take a step back. Sometimes we read Torah and we see figures, and all they are to us are names on a page, and we don't even connect the dots to if they're human beings, how they overcame, what they overcame, and we miss the whole point. We just assume they're perfect, and life is perfect for them. But I'm not. So just for a few minutes this morning, let me just give you the history of Yosef. Yosef's story begins when he's 8 years old. This week's parsha just landed. his dad's coming back to come. And the pasuk says that Yaakov takes the wives and then the kids behind them. Mom, kids, mom, kids, mom, kids, mom, kids. Esav shows up, and the way the pasuk basically flows it out, it says mom, kids, mom, kids, and then it ends by saying Yosef to Rachel. And Rashi goes, what do you mean? It should be Rachel for Yosef. Why is Yosef in front? And Rashi says, you know why? Because Yosef thought that Esav would look at his mom, who's very beautiful, and he didn't want Esav to look at his mom, so Yosef, the little 8-year-old boy, he's 8, stands in front of his mom, and he goes, don't look at my mom. You know why? Because Yosef began his life here. His mother was Mama Rachel. She was probably a pretty good mom. No other brothers to compete. He gets to be Mama's boy without anybody else to worry about. You can imagine they had the greatest time when she went to bed. You can imagine she was worried about it 24/7. You can imagine he and Mom were like this. And he was a little boy. His mom was Mama Rachel. Nobody to compete. And all of a sudden, he finds out she's having a baby. Oh, it's a boy. I don't know if girls can girls have cooties. And all of a sudden, he finds out that it's coming time. And he goes to his dad. And his dad goes into the tent. And his dad says, and he goes, was it a boy? Because I love Shalom's offers and chocolate and pretzels. It's amazing. Is it going to be a boy? And then his face is white. And his dad was mad. And he goes, it's a boy. He goes, yes. When did I see Mommy? He's 8. Now he goes, honey, mommy's in Shemayim. His whole life. I gotta tell you, all the brothers, no one's that shit right now. They all went back to their moms in the tent, except for Yosef. His life goes like this. But you know what? Yaakov's an incredible father. So Yaakov is pumping this kid up. He puts him next to him, he gives him a tiny pasuk, and he's killing him and working him and telling him, I see my whole life in you. And all the other brothers are like this, but he treats him differently. And Yosef came finally after a couple of years, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. He's sleeping, he's not sleeping, and waking up in the middle of the night, he's seeing dreams of his mom and his own special. He sees himself growing and being great, and he's 15, and he's 16, and he's 17 years old. And finally he's a man, and finally he's older, not older, but he's grown up, and his father sees him, and he's got a future, and his dad is fulfilling what his mom didn't give. And one day his dad says to me, Yosef, come here, you can go to that other town. I gotta tell your brother something. Remember this story? Now remember, boys will be boys. That's how it works. Anybody here raising boys, you know the rule? You raise 4 boys, you go right to heaven. You know that rule? We should be 7 in Chinese. No way you go straight to heaven because your life is hell. That's how it works. Right? Boys and girls. I got boys and girls. I gotta tell you. You know, you learn everything about kids by the school bus. The only thing we have left that's a wild, everything is law and order here except for that school bus. That's the wild, wild west. My boy's bus pulls up, and like I can see the fear in the eyes of the driver. I'm like, where are you going? He's like, whatever they'll take these kids. And now a body part flies over his head. And my son looks and goes, Daddy, I'm scared. I'm like, you will get on that bus, you will be fine. Gets on the bus, he comes back home, he's all roped up. My wife goes, I'm homeschooled, but I can't homeschool. I'm like, do you have your body parts? He's like, yeah, like, you'll get, like, you'll get back on the bus, you'll be fine again. And then my girl's bus pulls up. And I got my twin girls, and the girls' bus pulls up, and some 8th grader goes, twins! Oh, come on the bus, we're gonna play Mahanaim and make pigtails and pick out Reddy Rings, it's gonna be amazing. And the girls are like, I love girls! It was boys looking boys, right? I remember one time I sent my kid to camp. This is great. Men don't have like these natural things that women have, like cleanliness and showering and changing their clothes. That never comes to us naturally. If we didn't come from the middle of married women, it would be one generation more out. I remember one time my son went to camp for the first time, and my wife, God bless my wife, she packed for him outfits by day. So all he had to do was take out his clothes and put it in the shelves, and just, you didn't have to like worry about picking. You come to see him for visiting day. And my wife comes out and she looks at the cabin and she goes, wow, Moshe, you fold your clothes just like I do. And she goes, wait, this was how I folded it. Have you not changed your pants since you got here? Now I'm thinking, he says to my wife, well, it's the feds. And I'm thinking, it does look better. And she goes, Charlie, like, that's disgusting. Because boys will be boys. Let me tell you something. Boys will be boys, they'll drive you nuts, but let me tell you what they'll never do. Ever. They'll never have one brother come home from school and be like, listen, it's getting hard for mom and dad. Recession's killing us. I heard I get 10 bucks here in the bodega. Hasta luego. Enjoy Mexico. Yosef shows up and sees his brothers, and his brothers say, here's the deal, buddy. You're gone. He goes, guys, come on. He goes, no, you're gone. He goes, guys, I was a little bit too extra. I got a hold on you. But like, really? Put my head in the toilet with you and give me a swirly something. Not this. Because you're gone. Can you imagine? your own brothers. And in fact, there's an opinion in Chazal that speaks about how, if you notice the way the Mesorah has passed, think about this. You notice the way the Mesorah has passed so far? They were all very aware of their Mesorah. Had the Mesorah passed, usually there were two boys. And mom made a petition for her boy, and dad was the mom. Right? Two boys. Hagar had a boy, and Sarah had a boy. What did she say? Give her a hug. There were two boys. Yitzchak had two sons. Esau and Yaakov. What happened? Who did Esau pet? Esau, what did Ruben do? His two brothers, basically. Reuben and Yosef, two brothers. So if you think about it from the perspective of why Yosef never rejected his father, because there's an opinion that Yosef thought that it was all one big scheme. That it was Leah telling Yaakov it's not fair to Yosef. Can you imagine? Top of the world. The apple of your father's eye, you show up, and he wasn't part of the conversation. They pick him up, they put him in a caravan, and he's gone. To death. This is Egypt. He wasn't going to text you when I get there. There's no ways. This is it. And he goes down like this. You know what happens? He's Yosef. He shows up in Potiphar's house. Potiphar was the third most powerful man in all of Egypt. And he works his tail off. And he just climbs and climbs and climbs and climbs. 18 years old. He's the COO of the third biggest estate in the epicenter of civilization. And he gets right up again. The roller coaster continues. And you know what happens right when he gets there? Potiphar's wife makes a pass. You know what he does? The right thing. You know what should happen next? If God was running the world according to him, there should be balloons. Game over. You win. You know what he gets for doing the right thing? Jail for how long? A decade. And he's not going to jail getting dumped here. He's going to jail in a hole for a decade. And then what happens is Yosef, so he climbs and he climbs and he climbs and he climbs. And now he's best friends with everybody. He's the second in command. Two people come up to him that are the chief, the baker and the butler of the king. They give him dreams. He interprets them correctly. On the way, I was doing you a favor. Yeah, I got some talent. Can you mind, maybe? He goes, no problem. I'll hook you up. Don't worry about it. I'll email you. I'll get your number. I'll look you up on Facebook. On the way out, he sits by the windows a day, a month, a year. And down again. His whole life like this. And then, on Rosh Hashanah, 30 years old. He wasn't 80. This happened before he was 30. Call comes in. The king needs some help. Successful. Now, you hear this story, you know what the profile of the story would be? The profile of the story would be the kid was basically mad at God his whole life. This is like a standard kid. God throws him a couple of curveballs and he's like, where is God? But if you look at Yosef's life, he's almost firm when he gets to Egypt and then he gets back up when he was home. When he was home, he was telling his brothers, he gets to Egypt and the Pesach says, everything he touched, Hashem was not sliach b'yadav. And the Rashi says, what does it mean? It's shem shemayim shkurim fit. Everything was baruch Hashem. He gets to Egypt, you did a good job, it was baruch Hashem. How are you doing today, baruch Hashem? We thought seminary girls came out with baruch Hashem. They just came out with a jingle, baruch Hashem. Yosef came up with the lyrics, baruch Hashem. Paro goes, can you interpret the dream? What does Yosef say to Paro? Anybody work for a living? The boss goes, can you do the project? What are you not going to say? Well, in Mirza Shemeshato, the Mirza Shemeshato, what are you talking about? That you cursed at me? Paro in Egypt back then goes, can you interpret the dream? You know what Yosef says? It's not to me, it's a page. Is that yes or no? Later, the brothers say to him, oh, we're so sorry if Yaakov died. So, what do you say to the brothers? What are you joking me? It's a page. What happens to Yosef? He's sitting at home, he's telling his brothers, all of a sudden he gets sold. Abandoned, his life goes into turmoil, and he becomes steadfast with God. So I want to focus on one aspect of the pasuk. I want, if you can, just for today, just hone in on one little piece of the story. I want to go back. The point where Yosef was with his brothers. So if you remember the story, Yosef shows up, and the brothers put him in the pit, and they're eating. All of a sudden, they pick up their rods. There was a caravan of Yishmael coming for on Gilad. And this caravan had on it these spices, all these different types of spices. That's the story. And they put Yosef on this caravan, and there he goes. And Rashi asks a great question. Who cares? You got a caravan, I got it. You got to figure out how to get to Egypt. Well, who cares what commodities they're trading? What are you joking? This isn't a commodities book. So whether carrying no ha'olah or low or good spices, bad spices, what a waste of words in the Torah. You know what the Rashi says? You know why it has it there? Because it wants to show you that what Kosh Baruch Hu does to the tzaddikim. Kosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, hooks up his tzaddikim. Typically Arabs during that period of time were traders in petroleum and tar, and those were very bad-smelling items. But because Yosef was going down, Hashem switched it. This one caravan was going against the typical trading and carry on it all these sweet spices. That's the Rashi. Heard a beautiful Rashi. Really? That's how God hooks up his tzaddikim? I have an idea, God. You want to hook somebody up? How about have him bring him home? You think Yosef's going, I'm going to die. Huh. Is that the little spice? For real? Is that cinnamon? Oh, this is going to be amazing. Thank you, Hashem. What are you joking me? Who cares what the spices are? He's going to his death. He's not taking a road trip. This is God hook up for the tzaddikim. God can't be any more creative. When Yosef, who did nothing wrong, is now being sent down to be a slave. I have a beautiful, beautiful idea. This is the core of what I want to get across here. For a minute, let's be Yosef. His mom passed away. His family just sold him out. Arguably, his father was a part of it. And he's in the caravan on the way out. And how does he feel? What is the greatest fear that each and every one of us has? What is the one feeling that each and every one of us, at most, fears? When you speak to people that get older in life, there is one feeling that they can't handle. What is that fear? Little kids at home. You know the best part about the little kids are? Before the world gets to them, when they're very little, it's all honesty, all truth. You want to see truth? 0 to 3. And then once they get into the world, they got to play the game. Maybe a little 5, 6, 7. When the kids, at least my kids, make home from school, they're like bees. How did they find? They're all like on cross-examination. How did they find? They're just doing nothing. We're like, no matter. It's like the same thing about nothing. Someone talk to me for more than one word. I say one thing, and my kids love me. All I gotta say to them, forget it. All I say is, bedtime. And they go, bedtime? Bedtime, Daddy, can you lay with me? Can you be with me? I love you. I need you every second. I'm like, sorry, honey, I can't. I gotta work. Like, please, Daddy. And then they're the best negotiator. My kids are the best negotiators I've ever had. When you're a lawyer, you have that in the DNA. They go, please just lay with me. I'm like, I can't, honey. To 5 minutes, I can't, honey. To 15 seconds, I can't, honey. And my girls, for sure, you can't lay with your own child for 15 seconds. Because they know it's the ultimate bait and switch. They know that once they hook you in, you're stuck. You ever get that feeling? Because once you get in that bed, you can't think until they're sleeping. So you're in there, and then you become like an expert at breathing patterns. You know what I'm talking about? You're like, close your eyes now. You know, it's like, when you're sleeping out, then you gotta get out, but you can't get out. You know why? Because if you get out, the bed's gonna creak. So you become like a half ninja, half acrobat, like trying to get out. And as you're finally free, those beady little eyes pop up and they open. And where do you think you're going? But no, I wasn't leaving. I was stretching. Why would I want a life at 7 o'clock at night? Because kids are truth. You know what they fear more than anything in the world? Being alone. You know what we fear more than anything in the world? Being alone. That's the moment where everything bad can happen. The essence of not being able to connect is the feeling of not of being unneeded, is the feeling of being alone. That's what when your kids get married, lots of times moms and dads who have been taking care of kids the whole life, they don't want to do it themselves. Because they don't want to be replaced. They don't want to be alone. They want to be in their kids' lives forever. Yosef is on the way down and how he feels. Be Yosef for a second. Make him a human being. He is. He's totally abandoned. He's totally alone. And all of a sudden something happens. Is that spice on the caravan? Because these traders traded petroleum. Why do they have spice? Could it possibly be that they're holding, they're carrying spices? You see, Yosef had a sorrow on Golos. We're forgetting that everybody went to Golos. Abraham goes to Golos, to Egypt. Yaakov goes to Dulles when he runs away from Esau. It is totally normal in that world that people were running away or sent to Dulles. That was part of their Nesorah. However, until Yosef, every single Jew that did anything hard, what happened before the activity was God spoke to that person in their language. God came to Abraham in Abraham's language. God came to Yaakov with angels and he saw it in his language. Every single person, until Yosef, when God spoke, God went above into your language and communicated to you in the language that you speak. And for the first time ever, God sent a Jew down to Egypt and changed how he communicated. And he's not speaking in his language, and he's not speaking in God's language. Because if God walked around and speak to us in dreams and in our language, our whole mind would blow up. So the way God speaks to people in Dulles, the way God speaks to me and you, he doesn't talk to us in our ears. We don't go to bed at night and see angels. He speaks to us through the world. He speaks to us through the coincidences. He speaks to us through the things in our life that aren't supposed to go through and go this way. Every second of every moment of every day, God's talking to each and every one of us. But he can't talk to us regularly. How can we live our lives? Every morning I wake up and I do something good, God says, God does a good job. Our whole existence would change if I spoke to God the way Abraham did. And at that moment, the entire world shifted as God changed his conversation. And just like God told Yaakov, I'll be with you. God told Yosef, I'll be with you. But the difference was that God shifted how he spoke. He hooked up the tzaddik. You know how? By making sure that when he was on that caravan, the switch that took place was in the coincidences. Why are there spices here? And just follow the rest of the narrative of the story. Yosef pops that, and it's game over. It's God, 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 God. Because the essence of what it means to be successful, to be connected, is to be able to look how somebody else speaks, not the way I speak. And what was the essence of Yosef's greatness was that Yosef was able to look at circumstance and say, that's God talking to me. I don't know what he's doing, but he's with me. So guess what? If he's with me, I'll be with him. And he sticks with God, ups and downs, thick and thin. He's 18, 12 years of torture. 17, 13 years of torture until finally he hops and goes, that's why. Every single one of us lives our lives with a certain level of hashgacha around us. That means that all of us, in some incredible way that it's hard for a human being to capture, in some incredible way, every second of your day is God speaking to us. But we can't listen. No, we don't hear him. Not because he's not speaking. We don't hear him because we're waiting for him to talk in my language. We hear some miracle about Israel, about a soldier. Hashem should bless everybody in Israel, and all soldiers should be saved. We hear some miracle soldier, where a soldier bows down to save both in the middle of a war, and a bullet goes over his head, hits a pipe, makes a star date, and makes love around the Mediterranean, and sees grace, and all off like, oh my gosh, Hashem, 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 Hashem. Then you're driving a car, and a car swerves right around you, and you're this close to an accident. And it's like, okay, I got lucky. Every second of every day he speaks to us. And the question is, can we see? Now this is, in my opinion, the essence of success. Why? So let's get a little bit into it, and then I got the bigger point. The way we see in life, the way our brains work, everybody thinks they experience reality, they don't. The way our brains work is that none of us actually experience reality. Those of you who Thursday night spoke about this in depth. What we experience is a small portion of reality. All of us have what's called a schema. This is a concept discovered by a man named Jean Piaget. And I don't have a lot of time to discuss this. If you want this, you can email me. I'll give you a larger piece of this. But in short, that means is that if each and every one of us would experience reality in front of us, we would melt. Because as you go outside, there's stimulus everywhere. And if you were taking stimulus, the way it comes into your brain, you'd break down. If anyone here is or is raising a kid with sensory processing disorder, you know what I'm talking about. There are kids that take in too much stimulus. They walk into a supermarket, and they hear the conversations, and they hear the wheels of the shopping cart, and they hear that person that dropped the cereal box, And it all floods into their heads, and they literally melt down. What is one of the greatest gifts God gives us is not to give us the brain. He gives us what he calls a schema, which means we all take in a very short, small window of stimuli every single moment. We take in about 110 to 126 bits of information per second. No more. That's why multitasking is a total myth. Not true. When you multitask, what you're doing is being mediocre across the board. Great people never multitask. They switch tasks. Because you take that small little window and apply it all. That's why you're on the phone with somebody, and then they're multitasking. You can tell they can't, they don't know what you're talking about. They're just waiting for your voice to sound like a question so they can answer in one word answer. Because multitasking, and that's why in life, you're seeing only things that you can see that you know. And I said this earlier Thursday, so those of you I'm sorry to say this again. That's why you ever play the game Spot the Jew? You know the game Spot the Jew? One of my favorite games ever, Spot the Jew. Right? I said this Thursday night. I was in Yankee Stadium a few years ago, Asian client, and I wanted to dive in. So he was very respectful. He came with me to the kosher stand. And I see a Jew, like standard New York Yankee Stadium. Nice blue shirt, blue slacks, and a Yankee cap. As if he's hiding, you know what I mean? I go, what time's Mincha? And he's like offended. He's like, what about me, says Mincha? I'm like, for real? I'm like, everything about you says Mincha. You put on a hat and he's like, you know, are you joking? My Asian friend looks at me and goes, are you the Jewish Superman? I'm like, yes, I do. And so Bishop's like, how did you do that? It's like shekels, right? Nobody in the world knows you're wearing a shekel. Only we do. Right? Nobody. I was once at, I was in Cleveland doing a class for individuals for, you know, a wide variety of Jewish old denominations. One lady in the back, I forget if she was religious, she asked you a religious question, but it's not really religious, but sure, anything. She goes, I work in Cleveland, and I work with a bunch of very religious women, and they have the best hair ever. And it's like a frizzy day, and they're fine, and sometimes they change their hair during midweek. It's just a kind of expensive, ancient treatment you all know about. I'm like, that's definitely expensive, that's for sure. How come people aren't picking out the shekels? How come people can't pick out Jews? You know why? Because when you grow up in a life, you're around Jews so much. Our brains, through a thing called neuroplasticity, can see through the schema and see things that is invisible to everybody else. What a schema does, a schema is based on your beliefs. If you have knowledge, you don't just see the world, you see the world through the prism of that knowledge. You got a pediatrician that comes into the house. In New York, we have this thing called cold. It's weird. We have these white things that come from the sky called snow. It's a weird thing, by the way. Everyone comes there and see it and brings it back to you. And it's like weird. Like in the winter, we actually get cold. It's like that. So here, it's like 7 degrees in the morning. Like, I saw this coffee meeting. Yesterday, it was like 60 degrees in the morning. A woman came in, no joke, in Uggs and gloves. I'm like, holy cow, I haven't been to LA. It's amazing. So, kids get sick in the winter time because it's cold. My doctor comes in, he comes in, he tells all my kids, cough. I'm like, what just happened? How did you know you did that one, strep culture, that one not? What did you say? It's invisible to me. You know, just me, I went to medical school. I spent so many years with the knowledge of the schema that when I hear a cough, I can make out what is invisible to you. When you walk on an airplane, see the person coming through, and know that they're from in a second. How do you know that? Because you live, and your brain creates all this, if you will, neurological connections, and when you see through them, you see things that are invisible to other people. Your schema picks up the invisible. Now, the game of life is to see the invisible. Because if you're going to wait for somebody to talk in your language, you're going to wait your whole life for something that's not going to come. Success is seeing the invisible. Can you imagine if Yosef would have said, God didn't speak to me, but what happened to the Jewish people, not Yosef? His success came because he saw the invisible. What is Torah? What is it? This learning Torah and listen, but what is it? What is the essence of it? So the Maharal has a great approach. The Maharal says this. There's two ways in which you get information. It's unreal. What he calls Greek wisdom and Jewish wisdom, which is right around this time. And Greek wisdom in many ways is Western wisdom, because we are, proudly so, as Americans, we are, like I said Thursday night, we're products of a mixed marriage. One part of our family is Greco-Roman, law, engineering, philosophy, art, science. That's Greco-Roman. That's Greeks and Romans. And part of us values morals as Judeo-Christian, which came from Judaism. We really are, all of us, in incredible ways. This society, America, is really the product of both of those two worlds. And so Maharal says, not speaking about America, there's two ways that wisdom comes into your life. One way is the Western way, the Greek way. And what is that way? That is the way of observation. What you're doing all day is trying to understand nature. Nature is right in front of me, and I try to understand it, so I observe it, and I test it. And I try, that's wonderful, it's great. That's how you create vaccines, that's how you fly airplanes, it's amazing. That's how you build buildings, it's amazing. But what happens in that world that you think, that in which I see, is that in which is true. And you create this incredible bias to see. Because whatever is in front of me is real. Anyone here is an academia or a doctor, you know, 20, 30 years ago, somebody whispered into your ears, if you can't measure it, it's not real. Because if I can't touch it and measure it, if I can't compare it across the board, then it's not real. And we do this to our kids all the time. Grades, they're only as smart as everyone in their classrooms. I'm only as successful as the money I make compared to everybody around me. Or we move mitzvahs. You look at a Jew that looks a little different than us, and the size of a Jew in a second. How do we know what a Jew's heart, what's in a Jew's heart? Because in a world where we look and see what's in front of us and judge by what we see, that's the world that's in front of us. That's the Greek way of seeing the world, even if you make it Jews. But here's what Maharal says, what Torah is supposed to be. What Torah is supposed to be is not observing the world around you. That's special. That's part of living in the world. That's not Torah. What Torah is supposed to do, is that God gave us a mission on Har Sinai. And the words he used, so to speak, not on our scene, but in life, is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elohim, Hashem Echad. And the word Echad, it doesn't mean God is one, because we refer to him in the singular. It means that God is a unity. This is a world where when you look at things, everything in the world is the revelation of godliness. People are godly. It means that inside them is God. Things, everything in the world, the electricity, if you will, the spiritual electricity of how this world works, is godliness. And when you go into the world, what's happening is, if you take a human being and say, I can touch it and feel it, look, it does this, it does that, if I poke it here, if I feed it this, that's a very Greek way of seeing a human being. What a Jew is supposed to say is, the world is godly, that means that human being, really, is a revelation of godliness. Their body is the congealed soul, and that soul is godliness. That's this chair, this marriage, this kin, this world. All it is the mask of a truth called godliness that is in the entire world. And but for the Torah, we would have no idea how to do that. We would have no idea to know that the 7 days is different than the other 6 days. That the kin doesn't mean that when you have a child, doesn't mean that someone's giving you a body to work. That there's a certain amount of rules and obligations and how I have to treat them. The marriage is the two people that are communally living next to each other. Is nafsho kashur v'nafsho. The souls are intertwined. How would we ever know what spirituality is if there wasn't a book telling us left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right? And the Maharal says, you know what we do when we learn Torah? You know what we're supposed to be doing? Is looking to how to reveal godliness in every aspect of our lives. The whole goal of the study, and I don't mean studying just in a book, I mean living a life where this is what you do for a living. This is what it means to be a walking, live life, love, live, and learn Torah. What it means to be a Jew that's a bar Torah is to walk around your whole life and all you are seeing is the invisible. You don't see a person. You see the soul through the person. You don't see a challenge. You see the spirituality of the challenge. And Maharal says this is the goal of a Jew, is to not observe, but it's to reveal. Everything you're looking to reveal something in it. Every mitzvah that I do is trying to reveal something deeper. I don't just sit at Shabbos table because I was told a long time ago, how am I doing? Gotta go? 11 o'clock? Okay, just give me the 1 minute and 2 minutes. That's not an option. The whole purpose of life isn't to sit around and to look at a mitzvah and say, okay, this is what I got to do because this is my culture. It's for us to look closer and closer and see the invisible. This is what it means to me. This is how I feel. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. This is what I want to do to my kids. When you walk around your life and your schema is to take what the Torah is trying to turn you into. The Torah is trying to turn you into a person that never stops at the physical. Look at everything you've learned. The premise of everything you've ever learned is it's not physical. Because if it was physical, why would I eat this and not this? Why would this day be different than this day? Why would I care about this holiday versus that holiday? What in the world does it matter if everything seems physical? The whole purpose of learning is to train your brains to see the invisible. That's why there's a famous rabbi named Leib Nazir, Dr. Kohn Yerushalayim, he said that if you look at Greek wisdom, they learn through seeing. You look at Jewish wisdom, they learn through hearing. What does it mean seeing and hearing? It's because if you ever speak to someone who's blind, they'll tell you when you stop seeing, you pick up on things that everybody who sees misses. Because when you see sometimes, what you're looking at right now is you're looking at a world that seems sometimes to not be as truthful as it is. When you close your eyes and listen, you can see things, you can perceive things, you can see the invisible. Shema Yisrael. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. You look at the way you talk about Torah, how you look at Torah with a ma'amah. Basar ma'am. God created the world. How? Through hearing your speech. In Kabbalah talk, it's the difference between tzura, form, and Pinini's death. And the goal of Torah, when you learn it, from now on, is to be the same thing as the goal of life. To always search for the invisible. To always search for the way God speaks. To what God is saying is important. To what God is gearing us towards, something that's deeper than what the society around us tells us. And when a Jew learns in that fashion of revealing, not only do you see it in your business and your learning, what happens is your schema changes. You walk in life and all of a sudden there's a spice change and you go, of course, it's God. You see your challenges and your blessings and you go, wow, you don't see God everywhere. Your success in life is not just because you're with your people. Your success in life is because what you realize is that God is always communicating to you, guiding you and navigating you. You have humility to look for it. The goal of what it means to be a Jew and to learn Torah is to train yourself to see the invisible. Because it's only in the invisible that we become the people that we're meant to be. Because back when Greek was running Greek and they were throwing babies into the river, because on their practice called infanticide, the Jews stood up and said, in that baby there's an invisible soul, they would be Christ. And back when the Romans on Sunday were killing people in the Colosseum, file of the Jews standing outside the Colosseum on a little bench saying, you can't kill people, human life people would be crazy. And when marriage was, back in those days, forget what was going on, pederasty, all the Jews were saying, no, husband and wife, they're not just two people that are living together because they're attracted to each other and it's more efficient. There's a spiritual bond. What we do for, what we've been doing forever, what we do forever is to be the people that sees the invisible. And when we engage in Torah study with that perspective, and more importantly, or as importantly, we engage in our lives with that perspective. We act like Yosef. We start to listen to God in the way that He communicates. And then that we achieve Torah true success. Because success is not being who you want to be. Success is being who you're meant to be. And who but God knows how to get you there. So I'm sorry I got to run, but I want to thank you so much for the time.